have the pleasure of having All Things Scott and Shasta, and we'll kick that off with item number three, which is a flow enhancement opportunities identified through the Scott Valley Groundwater Study with Mr. Brian McFadden and guests.
Well, good afternoon, Chairman Noren and members of the board, members of the public. I'm Brian McFadden for the record, and for Donna. I have the pleasure to introduce the next item that you'll hear today, which is item three, and you're going to hear about flow enhancement opportunities that have been identified through the Scott Valley Groundwater Study. And I'll introduce the two gentlemen to my right in one moment, but first I want to give you all just a little bit of history on this to provide some context for what you're about to hear. The regional board's interest and involvement in groundwater issues in Scott Valley arose from the development and adoption of the action plan for the Scott River watershed sediment and temperature, total maximum daily loads, and really it was the Scott temperature TMDL. That was incorporated into the basin plan in 2006. And the work that went into that TMDL identified groundwater as a really important factor determining the temperature of Scott River. We could identify that, but we couldn't really quantify impacts to groundwater and contributions. It's a bit of a black box to us at that point. And so the action coming out of the action plan related to groundwater was a request that Siskiyou County develop a groundwater study plan by 2008. The county followed through on that, and through their with their blessing and support, Dr. Harder and his team, and also with financial support from the water boards, developed the Scott the Scott Valley Community Groundwater Study Plan, and met that commitment. Also, since the groundwater study plan was established, there have been other activities of note. There has been a community-led groundwater monitoring program. The number of wells has varied throughout the years, but it's between 30 and 35 generally. And that's private wells that the Water Trust had been going out or has been going out and measuring static water levels. That information's been really important for the work that Dr. Harder and his team have done. Also, in 2010, Siskiyou County established a groundwater advisory committee for Scott Valley. That committee's comprised primarily of irrigators and has been a body that has provided a lot of real-world information about water management in Scott Valley that's been really helpful for Dr. Harder and his team as well. The majority of the work since 2008 and what you'll be hearing about today has to do with the development of Scott Valley Integrated Hydrologic Model. And that model has been developed to investigate water management strategies to increase in-stream flows. And those investigations have resulted in the development of specific management scenarios to increase flows in the Scott River, and that's much of what you'll hear about today. Also, there has been a pilot project implemented to test the feasibility of these recharge projects, and you'll hear a little bit more about that also. But part of that effort was to understand, can this work? Will the irrigation, or not irrigation, the spreading of water in the wintertime impact the crops, primarily alfalfa, and the result was that the alfalfa didn't seem to be harmed, and also importantly that the spreading of the water worked out as planned, and that water sank into the ground, and as you'll hear about, recharged the aquifer. So that brings me to what you're about to hear. We have we're very lucky to have Dr. Thomas Harder and Mr. Gustali here to tell you about the work that they've been doing since well, in the case of Thomas, it's since 2008. Gus is a PhD candidate and has been working on this project as part of his dissertation. It's the subject of his dissertation, and he's got a lot to say about it today. You may remember, or some of you will probably remember, Gus had been before you in October 2014 up in Yreka, talking about the progress that had been made up to that point in developing and calibrating the model. And today we get to hear about the progress made in coming up with solutions to the flow issues. Before I turn it over to Thomas and Gus, I also want to mention, though, that there is additional information in regards to the Scott River TMDL on the Scott River TMDL webpage, and much more information about the work that Dr. Harder and his team have been doing, including a couple of peer-reviewed journal papers. Those are the first two. There's more to come that are in press or soon to be. So we have that to look forward to. But now I want to turn it over to Dr. Thomas Harder and Mr. Gustali to tell you about the good work that they've been doing in regards to groundwater and flow enhancement opportunities in Scott Valley.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, thank you for the opportunity to present today. I wanted to thank Brian for having us here today and for the work that we've done over the last almost 10 years. My name is Thomas Harder. I'm a groundwater cooperative extension specialist, also professor at the University of California in Davis. This has been really an amazing effort. Thanks to Brian's efforts to get us involved and keep us funded for the last 10 years. And thanks to the many efforts in the Scott Valley itself, where as a cooperative extension specialist, I've been engaged both through Brian, but also through the local farm advisor, Steve Orloff, with the community. We've worked with the groundwater advisory committee. We've worked with county. We've worked with the Quartz Valley tribe in meetings and sat down also with Fish and Wildlife. They have attended various meetings, so we've had various interactions. We usually visit once or twice a year with the Scott Valley in effort on moving forward. We've done a lot of field work with Steve Orloff, the farm advisor up there, and with the Resource Conservation District as well. So very, very interactive process, very interdisciplinary process. What I thought what we'll do today in this presentation is sort of a three or a four step. I want to give you a really brief introduction from a very intuitive level. What is this all about from a groundwater side? How does the groundwater work? And I apologize if this is going to be super basic and a repetition of things that you've already heard. I want to make sure we're all on the same page. And then sort of introduce to you this idea of this integrated hydrologic model. And then Gus will take over and tell you a little bit about what that model actually does and how we're applying that model as we're moving forward. So I want to start out and talk about sort of this groundwater basin, Scott Valley groundwater basin. I like to talk about our California groundwater basins, most of them, not all of them, being essentially bathtubs that are filled with sediments, like this, what you're seeing on this slide, where you have the mountain range being the bathtub walls. Not quite impermeable, but while there is groundwater in there, that's not really where we would put an agricultural well in to pump 500 gallons per minute or 1,000 gallons per minute. We do that in these sediments that have been washed off the mountains, and deposited, and are full of groundwater. In the groundwater is that water that fills that pore space between the sediment particles, much like the water in your flower pot fills the pore space between the soil that you have in your flower pot. And so as rainfall recharges this groundwater basin, but also streams as they come out of the mountains on these upper alluvial fans, recharge into this groundwater basin. This groundwater basin fills up, and where does that groundwater first show up when this basin fills up? Well, it shows up at that lowest point, right? If you keep filling up a bathtub that's full of sediment and you keep pouring water in it, That water eventually shows up at the surface, and the first place it shows up is at the lowest point. And that lowest point in the Scott Valley and in most of our other basins, including here in Santa Rosa, is where the river is. And so that's usually where groundwater shows up first. And these basins are actually so full with groundwater that there's a balance between the groundwater that goes in, be it that it's recharged from these streams or from precipitation or from irrigation, and groundwater that leaves that basin, and it leaves right there at the river. This is a phenomenon we call base flow in hydrology. When it hasn't rained for 2 weeks and there's still water in the stream and it doesn't come from a reservoir, this is where the water comes from. It comes out of our groundwater aquifers. So base flow is an important phenomenon, including in the Scott Valley. And then we have pumping, and when we pump water, we take some of that water that would otherwise go to the stream, and use it for other purposes. Public supply in the Scott Valley, it's almost exclusively for irrigation supply. We pump that in the summer, and then in the winter, we let it relax, and it goes back, the water levels go back. A big concern typically exists when we pump more than we recharge and we get overdraft, where we then get a complete disconnect or a partial disconnect with the stream. Now, that's not the case in the Scott Valley. As part of this effort that Brian mentioned of measuring water levels through this private monitoring well network, we've been able to look at longer-term trends. We now have 10 years' worth of data. These are seasonal water level data. Blue line is winter, green is spring, red is summer, and brown is fall, going from 2006 to 2016. You can see within any given year between winter and summer, there's about a 5-foot difference in water levels. And as we go through drought periods, 7, 8, and 9, we lose about 10 feet of water that we gain in the wetter years. And this winter, we're actually back to the very wet year of 2006, almost as far as water levels are concerned. So there's not a long-term overdraft that's evident from the monitoring that we're doing here. The main concern is really the pumping and the impacts of the pumping on stream flow. When you pump water, there's eventually less water that goes to the stream. There's a time delay effect, depending on how far away this well is from the stream, that can last from, it can be a day or 2-day delay, that much of the water that's being pumped comes from the stream. If it's a well close to the stream, if the well is a quarter mile away or half a mile away or a mile away, it might be a month or it might be 2 months before the stream sees that impact. Similarly, if there's flood irrigation or some intentional recharge, that recharge will eventually not make a difference to the stream other than there's less water in the stream if it comes from the stream. And that pulse of water that's recharged into the groundwater will then slowly make its way back towards the stream. And you can see the steepening of the gradient here, which means there's more water going into the stream. And so there's the recharge through the time delay, through this time delay will eventually also then have an impact of the stream. And one of the things that Gus will talk about is we can take water out during times when we have a lot of water, put it in groundwater, and then that will have an impact to flows 2 months, 4 months, or 5 months later when there's much less water in the stream to help support that stream flow. And that's part of our effort. So that said, what we have in the Scott River is we have stream flows during the winter that are relatively high. We have about 500,000 acre feet of water going through the Scott Valley per year. Those stream flows right about now start dropping off quite drastically as the snowmelt is over. And we have fairly low stream flows typically in August, September, and into October. The growing season is from April to September. Come late September or October, we have Chinook, fall Chinook run coming up the Klamath River and into the Scott Valley, and later Coho and the Juneau Coho are staying in the upper watershed, and some of them may be staying in the main stem of the Scott River in the Scott Valley. This is a really critical period here for the fall run of the Chinook. The summer is critical for the juvenile coho in terms of stream flows and in terms of stream temperature. And supporting stream flows during this period is sort of the goal of the efforts up there. And our modeling efforts are intended to help design what we're doing in terms of supporting that stream flow. So our model essentially consists of three elements that together encompass the hydrology in the Scott River watershed. One part is the upper watershed, so the mountains around Scott Valley. That in our effort is at the moment represented through a regression model that we have developed that allows us to provide, to calculate daily stream flows on the tributaries and on the Scott River at the boundary of the Scott Valley, sort of as these rivers move into Scott Valley. So we have numbers of surface water that comes into the valley. In the valley, on the valley floor itself, we have a what we call a soil water budget model. That's essentially a water routing model for the landscape, the agricultural, predominantly agricultural landscape, but also the natural landscape on the valley floor, to look on a daily basis at the water budget of individual parcels in that valley. We're using essentially a tipping bucket, mass balance, daily mass balance approach, to calculate the water routing through that landscape, including the demands on irrigation water, the pumping, and the recharge. And then the third component is the groundwater and surface water in the Scott Valley, which is represented through a numerical model that Gus will talk about. So the soil water budget model, when we put that soil water budget model together, it represents the soil water fluxes on individual fields in Scott Valley. And one of the things that came out of that exercise was we actually calculated the amount of irrigation water based on the evaporative demand, the evapotranspirative demand of the crops, and where the latter is a fairly well-known number. We also know how much surface water rights are available, and based on a difference between what water is available from surface water or not available from surface water because people don't use it, and the evapotranspirative demand from the crops, we were able to calculate groundwater. The other number that we can calculate with this model is how much water gets lost from the root zone to groundwater in form of recharge. Well, we calculated that the folks are irrigating about 33 inches on alfalfa, and one of the advantages of being fairly close contact with growers in the valley was that as we presented these numbers, they said, well, this is not really possible. We don't have irrigation equipment set up here that would allow us to put 33 inches of water on the ground during the irrigation season, just based on the number of times to irrigate and the amount of water that they can possibly put through their pressure valves. It was very clear that the actual irrigation amount is much lower. So we went through an exercise of looking at why we have this mismatch, which actually then triggered 3 years' worth of research with my colleagues Steve Orloff and Rick Snyder. Steve is the farm advisor in Siskiyou County. Rick Snyder is a climate expert. And they actually measured ET, they measured the irrigation water amount, and they measured soil water content on 8 fields in the Scott Valley over 3 years to determine what are the ET numbers that we were using are correct, to determine what the actual irrigation amount is, and to determine what the soil water budget actually looks like over these 3 years. And with that field work in place, we were able to actually recalibrate our soil water budget model to get to the actual irrigation amounts of about 20 to 22 inches per year, and adjust those numbers based on that field work. And it turns out that, in fact, they're doing much less irrigation alfalfa. It takes much more advantage of soil moisture storage from winter rains and also has much less recharge than we anticipated. So this information now feeds into the groundwater surface water model. Both the pumping and the recharge become really big drivers for the groundwater surface water model. And I'm going to let Gus talk about that part.
Thank you. So for the record, my name is Gus Tully. Thank you for having us here today. So I'm not going to get into the details of the model. It's a highly discretized model that runs from water year 1991 through water year 2011. It's been through an extensive sensitivity analysis and calibration, and essentially this is a result of that. So on this top left plot, we have observed heads. So these are actual water level measurements that have been collected up in the valley. And then on the x-axis, we have our simulated head. So this is where what the model is actually predicting at that same location at that same time. So if our model was perfect, we would have all of our all these blue dots would be falling on this what we call a one-to-one line. So our simulated head would match perfectly with our observed head. Our model's not perfect. No models are. but it's very close. You can see we have a very high correlation between our observed head and our simulated head, and our slope is right around one. So we have quite a bit of confidence that our model is actually representing our groundwater heads. On the right, you see the residuals. These are essentially just the simulated minus the observed. This gives us an idea if our model is biased, either positive or negative, as far as groundwater heads go. We don't see a whole lot of bias. There are a few problem wells, which is pretty consistent with a lot of models. But overall, we're matching our groundwater heads very well. The bottom left shows our observed and simulated stream flow. So blue is observed stream flow, and then red is what our model is actually predicting at the outlet of the valley. And this ranges over three orders of magnitude. And essentially, with the exception of these really high winter flows, we're capturing both the timing and the magnitude of the stream flow exiting the valley. So overall, our model is pretty well representing the actual observations that we're seeing. And if we look at individual wells, we're capturing both the timing and the magnitude of these groundwater fluctuations. So we have quite a bit of confidence that our model is accurately predicting or is accurately simulating what we're actually observing in the Scott Valley. And so, and one other model validation that we did is we had Siskiyou County RCD go through and actually map where dry sections occur in the Scott River and its tributaries during an average year and a dry year. So none of this data was actually incorporated into the calibration, so it's completely independent. And the wide transparent red lines are areas in the model where we simulated a dry or disconnected reach, and we've just defined that as anywhere that has less than one CFS of flow. And then the blue lines are where it's flowing, and then these thinner dark lines are the actual observations of dry and flowing sections. You can see in dry years, there's excellent agreement between where the dry sections are actually located and where our model predicts them to be. And in average years, we see a higher degree of agreement as well. So we're very confident that our model is representing conditions in the Scott Valley. And so there's a lot of things that this model can do. One is that we can use it as a learning tool. We can look at what the water budget is doing, where the major flows are. We can identify data gaps and so on and so forth. Another application is as a management tool, and we've done this a little bit already, so we can estimate current hydrologic conditions using the model. One application, these blue and red dots here are where the monitoring wells in the Scott Valley are located, and what we do is we can actually go out and measure these water levels in real life, but we don't know what the actual storage in the aquifer is doing, because that's something that we can't actually measure accurately. But that is a number that the model outputs, and we do get water levels from the model as well. So what we've done is we've actually just created a simple regression model between changes in storage from the model and changes in water level, and we see that there's a pretty strong correlation between the two. And so what we can do is when we measure these water levels in real life, then we can use this equation, and so we know what the change in water levels are, and so we just look on this line and see what the change in storage is. And so that's what this graph is showing from 2006 through 2016 and the early part of 2017. And this is all relative to the long-term average that we have. So anything that's above zero is there's greater storage relative to the long-term average. Anything that's below that line is decreased storage relative to long-term average. And these red bars show the periods of drought. So you can see we're decreasing our storage during drought, and we're increasing it during wet periods. So our model's pretty consistent with what we would intuitively believe to be happening in the Scott Valley during these wet and dry periods. And so we've submitted this as part of the adjudicated basin annual reports as well. And so the third and possibly more important application why we're here today is to look at scenario testing. And so we can use the model to play what-if scenarios. And so we're not limited by physical constraints, legal constraints, financial constraints, with the exception of computational cost to actually run the model. And this can help provide guidance on what may be either the optimum solution or combination of solutions for increasing late summer stream flow or whatever other criteria that we specify. And all of these what we call conjunctive use scenarios, which are utilizing groundwater and surface water as a single resource instead of treating them separately like we traditionally do, these are all predicated on the fact that the Scott Valley is a storage-limited system as opposed to a water-limited system. So if you look at the average annual stream flows that go through the valley and the annual average ET demand, and this is a conservative estimate because it's assuming that all the ET, the entire valley is covered in alfalfa, which is a very high-demand water crop, there's about five times the amount of discharge as the ET demand. So there's plenty of water. The problem is it's just not happening at the right time, and this is pretty consistent with California in general. And so what we're trying to do is increase the residence time of the water in this system. And so surface water has residence times on the order of hours to maybe days. It gets routed through the system very quickly, and there's not a lot of opportunity to take advantage of it. Groundwater, on the other hand, has residence times of days to months, possibly even years, depending on where it's being recharged. And so what we want to do is add a hydrologic speed bump. We want to slow this water down as it's coming through the valley, because since most of this is coming through during those wet periods, if you extend that residence time, you're more likely to have it discharged to the stream during those critical low flow periods. And so the four conjunctive use scenarios that we've identified so far are managed aquifer recharge, and I'll discuss the details of these specifically later, what we call in-lieu recharge, a combination of the first two, and then also using beaver dams or beaver dam analogs. And so today I'm just gonna talk about the first two and some preliminary results from those. So managed aquifer recharge is essentially using agricultural fields as temporary spreading basins. So you don't have to take this land out of production, but you can still utilize it to add some additional water during the wet periods. And so we do this, we flood these fields during crop dormancy. We do flood irrigation because it's a quote-unquote inefficient irrigation, which inefficient irrigation means efficient groundwater recharge. So we want to add more water to the groundwater table. And flows are high and demand is low. So this is an opportune time to try to pull water out of the river and apply it to fields where you're not going to lose it to ET demand. And so one of the concerns is this going to cause additional consumptive use? And it's likely not, because the timing of this, again, is when ET demands are low. The growers are pretty much already irrigating as much as they want or can, as Dr. Harder mentioned earlier. And so there's not going to be any additional agricultural expansion. There, at least in the Scott Valley, all that ag land has already been put into production, and there's not a whole lot additional ag land that they can expand into. And so we anticipate that the additional recharge will be partitioned into predominantly increased stream flow, and a small portion will likely go to increased evapotranspiration from riparian areas that are right on the margin of if they can access groundwater or not, because we'll be slightly increasing groundwater levels, and so therefore they may be able to pull off a little bit more water. But this is going to be relatively small relative to the increased stream flow proportion. So the other concern that we have is this going to negatively affect fish habitat during the winter months while we're actually diverting? The winter diversion accounts for about 5% or less of the annual or of the long-term average flows during those 3 months, so it's very small proportion. And the potential for habitat benefit greatly exceeds the potential for harm. And this is just a graphic that shows this is the average stream flow for each day of the year, and the red line shows the maximum proposed diversion. And you can also put in place systems where if it drops below, say, for example, the Forest Service right of, I think the interim flow is 440 CFS during this time, that you don't divert. But predominantly this water is available. Most of the flows are above that interim flow criteria. And so for the managed aquifer recharge, as we've implemented it in the model specifically, is on 1,400 acres that's identified in these pink fields right here. And so these are all down gradient of the Scott Valley Irrigation District ditch, and they're as far away from the Scott River as possible to try and maximize that travel time from where the water is being recharged to where it discharges at the Scott River. And we divert water January through March at the SVID diversion point, which totals about 7,500 acre feet for the 3 months in total. And this leverages current infrastructure for the lowest investment cost. So we're using an existing ditch. We're able to apply this using gravity operations. There will be some improvements that are needed just to improve or to maintain the flood irrigation, because a lot of farmers have neglected that ability because they use wheel line or center pivot. But this is still a relatively low-cost scenario to implement. And what this plot is showing is the differences in stream flow relative to a base case condition. So this would be either the gains or losses relative to business as usual if we implemented managed aquifer recharge. So anything that is a positive value is going to be a stream flow increase, and anything that's red is going to be a stream flow decrease. And so you can see while we're diverting in January, February, March, we're diverting about 42 CFS, but we only see a maximum of about 30 CFS at the actual gauge, because some of that water is reaching the Scott River within the same month. There's some very short residence times. These things are a distribution. So you get some short, some medium, and some long. So some of that water goes back into the Scott River within that same month. And then you see it decreases as you move through. And then after we stop with the diversion, we see our greatest increases are in the months following. And then there's a decay as we move through the year. So during the late summer, the critical months, we see an increase anywhere between about maybe 2 to 5 CFS on average. And again, so decreased flow while we're diverting, but then increased flow during that critical time.
Mm-hmm. And is that from the three sites you're talking about, and relative to where do you see 5 CFS adjacent to those sites at a gauge station?
So this is at the USGS gauge at the outlet of the basin. So this is integrating all the flows in the basin. This is what's coming out of the valley.
But Gus, are you saying that this is from the three pilot feasibility projects you've done? So from three projects diverting that amount of CF or that amount of acre feet, you've seen that amount of increase?
So this is a modeled situation. This is a hypothetical. So this is using the model to predict what might happen.
Okay.
So this is applying 7,500 acre feet over 3 months to these 1,400 acres that are identified in pink here.
And that's the equation. That's the basic buy-in equation. 1,400 acres, 7,500 acre feet would buy essentially 5 CFS through critical time period in October.
It's about 2 to 3 CFS in the late summer, and then about 18 or 19 CFS in April, and then it decreases from there. But somewhere in that range, depending on the month.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Oh, no problem. And this plot is just showing August and September streamflow increases. So these are for each water year, what the actual flows are. The black line is August. The red line is September. So in red here, we have our driest years. So we see our greatest streamflow increases when we have our driest years, because when there's not a lot of water available, adding a little bit of extra recharge really makes a big impact. Whereas in the wet years, there's not a whole lot of variation because there's already some water in the system. Adding a little bit more water, it helps a little bit, but it doesn't make as big of an impact. And there's been a pilot project that was run by Professor Dahlke at UC Davis. This is a 15-acre plot with a 9-year-old alfalfa stand. And there were four different treatments. There was a continuous water application area, a high water application area, low, and then a grower standard, which was essentially no water applied in the wintertime and then standard irrigation practices during the growing season. And the take home from this is that they were able to apply up to 25.6 feet per acre on the continuous treatment. So the potential for managed aquifer recharge is quite high. And of that water, upwards of 90% was actually reaching the groundwater table. So this isn't being lost to ET, and essentially the majority of the water, the vast majority of the water that is being recharged is actually reaching the groundwater table. And as Brian mentioned earlier, we haven't seen a discernible effect on crop yield, but this needs some further investigation because there's not a whole lot of data points to go off of. So the other scenario that I talked about, which is the in-lieu recharge scenario, is this is using surface water instead of groundwater on selected fields while it's available. So this is going back to a time pre-1977 where most people were irrigating with surface water and not utilizing groundwater. And so we've identified about 6,000 acres here in green in the valley floor where the fields still have their legal water rights, but they forego those to use groundwater because it's much more reliable and they're using center pivot and wheel line systems that have to be pressurized, and it's easier to drill a well to pressurize them than to pull surface water. And so what this does is it delays a portion of the groundwater pumping until later in the summer. So those streamflow depletion effects that Dr. Harder was talking about earlier, we're pushing them back, and they're more likely to happen during the wet winter months than in the late summer because we're delaying the start of that pumping, and so we're going to delay the timing of those effects until later in the year. And so this is a similar plot that I showed earlier, but this is for the streamflow difference using the in-lieu recharge scenarios. So we see there's a decreased flow during the growing season, which starts in mid-March, early April, and proceeds through until the stream flow is gone. And then once we stop once we use all the surface water, they switch back over to groundwater. So we're letting the farmers irrigate with as much as they want originally. We're just changing what the source of the water is. But we see dramatically different or increased flows during these late summer stream flow months. You notice these error bars are one standard deviation. So these are monthly averages for the 21 years. And there's a lot more variation on these relative to the managed aquifer recharge scenario. And this is because managed aquifer recharge is just pulling a relatively small amount of water, and it's consistent, so there's not a lot of variation in that. We have, in California, as you know, really wet years and really dry years. So there's a lot more variation on how much water is going to be available from year to year. So that's why these error bars are quite a bit bigger. And this is the same plot as before, just for the in-lieu recharge scenario. So again, in the dry years, we actually see the opposite of the managed aquifer recharge scenarios, where you actually have your lowest stream flow increases during the dry years because there's just not a whole lot of surface water to apply. But in the wet years, you see your largest gains. But still, even the baseline gains relative to the managed aquifer recharge scenario are about an order of magnitude. So it's pretty significant for these preliminary results. And this is a plot of the actual pumping reduction from implementing in-lieu recharge relative to base case. And so we can reduce groundwater pumping anywhere between about 5,000 to about 10,000 acre feet a year, and in dry years, you see we don't reduce it a lot, but in wet years, we reduce it quite a bit because you can supplement that groundwater pumping with surface water diversions. And as a fraction of the pumping percentage, it's anywhere between about 10 to 25% or so. The potential concerns for in-lieu recharge are that the spring and the summer flows are going to be reduced because of these diversions. And really the question is, I'm not sure what happened here, but the real question is, are these diversions more beneficial in the late summer than during the actual time that you're diverting? And the model suggests that they are, but this is likely going to need some much more complex 2D surface water modeling. For example, there's a master's student at UC Davis that does this type of modeling where they look at, this is specifically for rainbow trout, but you can apply it for any species. Where they look at flow velocity and depth and use those to determine what the actual habitat benefits are relative for different flows. And there is precedence for this in-lieu recharge scenario because pre-1977, the average minimum, so this, if you take the lowest flow for each year before 1977 and average it, it's about 43 CFS. If you do the same thing after 1977, it's about 17 CFS. So 1977 is a big year because that was our big drought year. There was a big push towards more efficient irrigation. A lot of people moved towards center pivots and wheel lines and moved away from flood irrigation. So you increased your irrigation efficiency, but you decreased your groundwater recharge, and you also increased your net extractions from the aquifer. So what we're trying to do is move more towards a pre-1977 condition and increase this baseline up a little bit. And so these conjunctive use scenarios, they represent a potential win-win scenario for farmers and fish, because the farmers can still irrigate with the total amount of water that they want, but they can also increase stream flows for fish habitat. And there is a potential, if we implement both these systems together, that there's a synergistic effect, because as you can see during the time where managed aquifer recharge is increasing flows, and I should note that these are different scales, but where the maximum increase for managed aquifer recharge may help fill in the gap on this in-lieu recharge. So some future work that we've considered with our group is to incorporate some parameter uncertainty analysis. So there's a lot of basically knobs that are involved with this model, and if you turn some of them, it affects the model slightly differently. And so our calibrations, we get specific values, but then there's a range of what that value is likely to be. And as you turn these knobs, you get different outputs, and therefore you may change the timing and the magnitude of some of these stream flow increases. So we want to have a better understanding of what's the minimum and what's the maximum likelihood of the stream flow increases given the total parameter uncertainty of the model. Another thing that we want to do is we want to add feedback from our mod flow model back into our water budget model. Currently, it just goes in one direction from the soil water budget model into the groundwater surface water model. And so we want to actually increase the the communication between them and have the groundwater model be able to talk back to the survey or to the soil water budget model. There's also talk about using the model to simulate the effect of beaver dams or beaver dam analogs that are currently being implemented in the Scott Valley. Another option may be to look at a pre-development scenario, see what are the potential natural stream flow conditions, and use these to help inform in-stream flow requirements. And then another option is to create a more sophisticated upper watershed model. So as Dr. Harder said earlier, we just use a simple regression model right now, but there's a potential to actually create another model on top of this. Complicates things, but you get a little bit more control and a little bit more detail and understanding about what's happening in the upper watershed, which ultimately is what really drives stream flow in the Scott River. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Well, first off, thank you very much. I've seen actually Dr. Harder and you too, Gus, one time present this, and it's always an amazing thing to see this type of science and this quality of hydrologic and hydrologic modeling come into a basin like this. It's a huge thing to have the credibility of UC Davis. It's a huge thing to have the collaboration of also in a groundwater group in this basin that's, you know, along with county of Siskiyou, that's working towards this. Question, just so I'm clear, though, Gus, is this is a model run. This has not yet happened. This is proposed then into feasibility projects that are yet to come. Is that correct?
Correct. The only thing that's happened is that pilot project that I've showed. And for the sake of time, I didn't go into the details of the groundwater increases. It would be, at the pilot scale, it'd be very difficult to measure any flow increases because it's such a small amount of water that we're adding for the pilot project. But scaled up, this does have the potential. And so what we're using the model for is to get an idea of what the potential in stream flow increases may be if you did scale this pilot project up. Because there is some cost associated with scaling, you know, anything up, especially implementing a pilot project. And so it gives us an idea of what could we or should we expect from doing this? And is it worth doing?
Yeah. I wrote down a ton of stuff, but I'll break it down into three things. So that as I look then, you know, we're water quality, but water quality is often coupled with water quantity, right? And this is a largely, as I know the Scott River system, one piece of this is the tension between timing of water and that quality of water that's there at that time, right? That this is largely driven, or at least a piece of this is driven by Endangered Species Acts and fish, and that's a piece of it. And that for us, water quantity and water quality is starting to become more of a paired commodity, right? That's not just wet water. We want wet water that's cold, right? And we see that throughout, you know, California. We've seen that in the drought was a perfect example. Looking at that then, this is a tool for potentially filling the teapot, essentially, and to manage the teapot. At the same time, you know, I myself in my past have worked with some of the farming community to get them to do irrigation management using neutron probes or tensiometers or something like that, so that truly agronomic rate is agronomic rate here. Is envisioning the model and the use of this model and the outcomes of it as a management tool to have wet water that's cold water that you're banking and sinking, saving through these management scenarios, I would imagine there could be added layers of how then information is input, not to the model because the model probably becomes way too complicated, but management tools that affect essentially behavior, right? That's a timing of irrigation or a quantity of irrigation. And that those feasibility studies, question that comes out of that is then how do you design and test the model with the other kind of component parts to it to get to validate that, hey, this could work here, you know? Because I've heard this kind of stuff in Scott Valley before, and it's always been very interesting to think about, yeah, sink it, slow it, save it. Makes a lot of sense, right? And yet, as you say, in 1977, they moved from a model of essentially a low-efficiency flood irrigation system to a high-efficiency center-pivot wheel-line irrigation, but that's all extractive, you know? So how do you design the project from here? What do you envision as seeing a way to take that forward and to do the, you know, that scenario of these, say, three fields or these three blocks to supplement that irrigation? What's the mechanism either through, and maybe it's a question for you too, Brian, because I don't want to put this all on you, Gus. You're the model guy and the smart guy in the room. But the thing is that as it goes, how do you use this as a tool then? How do you get it down to the level of the irrigation community to go for it and use this productively?
Mr. Chairman, if I may just jump on in on and sort of, because this has been for us part of the whole equation, and also having been very engaged in the development of SIGMINE and the development of the regulations for SIGMINE and being aware of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, really for the first time making an explicit connection between groundwater and surface water, there's a lot of thinking statewide right now how to go about understanding that interface, but also what some of the actions might be that may have to be taken. Our process has already started. The pink fields and the green fields that you've seen identified on this map have been identified in an interactive process with the Groundwater Advisory Committee and with growers in the valley. And so what we said is, if we're going forward with actually using a scenario analysis, we would like to know where this is even feasible. And so while it wasn't an explicit scientific exercise to identify those fields, it was really a stakeholder-driven exercise to define those, somewhat informal, but still a stakeholder-driven exercise to identify what would be the most likely places this could actually be done. So I think the first step is already done, in that there is a buy-in by the local community into implementing these particular projects. Then the next step will have to be an engagement with the Groundwater Advisory Committee and of the Groundwater Advisory Committee with the local growers, in seeing what funding is needed to implement this, and at what point, how do we go about this, both from financially and then from an infrastructure perspective. But I think the modeling lays the groundwork to convince all involved stakeholders that this may or may not be worth it, right? If this exercise had turned out to be yielding a tenth of a CFS in September, then it probably wouldn't be worth pursuing it. Right. But if these results hold up as we're going through a QA/QC process with the modeling effort that Gus has engaged in to make sure that we really did all of the steps correctly, if these numbers hold up and we do gain somewhere between 5 and 20 CFS in September from this process, that certainly seems to be a big increase towards a stated goal that's now been set by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, who's just set interim stream flow requirements for the Scott River at about 35 CFS in that critical low flow period, based actually on the early period that Gus showed when we had those flood irrigations in place. And this is only an interim in-stream flow requirement. I'm sure they will be refining that further as we go move forward. Yeah, but just to kind of, in terms of where we want to go, is towards flows in the critical period between 20 and 30 CFS, from currently sometimes less than 15 CFS, less than 20 CFS, and adding the 10 or 20 to it is a significant increase.
Yeah, that's huge. And just one other thing is that under SIGMA, SIGMA, I think this is a medium priority basin under SIGMA.
This is a medium priority basin.
This puts this basin so far ahead on SIGMA, it puts it ahead of most of California. We're lucky here that in Sonoma County, USGS did a model on the Central Rosa Plain and Sonoma Valley, and they're going to do Petaluma, and it puts it just in the exact same position. So we're the benefit of this now having happened in two significant basins twice, basically.
Right. And to speak to that point, being very active as an extension specialist and engaged with the state and answering some of these questions on how do we go about this groundwater surface water undesirable results piece in the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, we've used the Scott Valley as an example, as a case study, to inform a lot of the discussion that has gone on. I was at UC Berkeley 2 weeks ago to talk about the water rights aspects of this, and there were five case studies from around California, and one of them was the Scott Valley.
Interesting. Brian, I actually cut you off, and I'm sorry.
That's fine. I just wanted to add, there is another component to making this happen, which is sort of the regulatory side of things.
Yes.
And to do a project like this, it does require a water right, which there are many water rights in Scott Valley, but not for this time of year with these kinds of magnitudes. And so the pilot project that you heard about involved a water right application. And subsequently, I do want to point out that that water right application and the granting of that temporary right was pretty groundbreaking in that it was the first of its kind, and for a recharge project, not specifically for groundwater banking where you put the water in and you take it out to use later, you know, it's for ecological benefit. So to make this happen, there will have to be the water rights established. There had been an attempt to get a water right established for this coming winter, which could have been better coordinated amongst the agencies and all involved. And there were concerns expressed about the flow impacts, which are legitimate concerns. And so part of what I'll be working on moving forward is making sure that those concerns get addressed and we have the right kind of coordination among agencies, and that the things get worked out before the application is submitted so that, you know, we have a green light moving forward.
Well, it's just tremendous because, you know, we've interacted and moved more towards flow as an agency. Again, the nexus of quality and quantity, we've moved towards flow in certain ways, and we've done that in smaller steps. But this is a management tool that potentially has significant benefits. You're right, it's not just to put this in and out like, you know, Inland Empire or Niles Cone or something. This is much different. This is actually for an ecological benefit. This is beneficial use stuff that is not just using it to irrigate alfalfa, really. And by the way, Gus will get a PhD out of this, I imagine.
Yeah, that's ideally.
Maybe.
But I will add your question earlier about quality is right now it is just a quantity model. We don't have quality associated with
that's
it.
Okay.
But there is a potential to add that capability in the future as likely another PhD student down the road. So this model can be potentially expanded, but for right now we're just looking at, you know, quantity because that's the precursor to getting the quality.
Yeah, super cool.
And if I could add just a little bit, I spent a lot of time walking up and down Scott River and putting thermometers in groundwater seeps. That water comes out cold.
I'll bet it
does. Comes out about 57 degrees, which is about 14 degrees C, and really optimal for coho and other salmonids. Problem is that it gets heated up right away in the sun, you know, without the riparian vegetation, and there's just a little too little of it. But the quality is there.
if I can add to the as far as the water rights application is concerned, the model was instrumental in convincing the state water board what happens to this water that's being recharged, because the recharge in itself is not a beneficial use. The water board expects us on the temporary water permits application that Scott Valley had to file for diverting this water under this additional water rights application. So the water board wants to know what ultimately happens with that water.
Yeah.
And so what we were able to do with the model is to show that ultimately this water goes back to the stream and actually also put sort of a temporary timeline on that impact back to the stream on it. But principally that all of this water goes back to the stream as opposed to somewhere else.
Well, would it put it back in a time period, at least on that scale right there, at a time that at least in part is outside of the diversion season for surface water, because surface water diversion is typically not all year, I believe, right? It usually goes into October,
first? November, and then starts up in March.
Yeah. April. Other questions for these guys? As it goes then, I actually look forward to seeing these types of projects, because to me, I think this is where we need to go when we start to look at cold water systems like this that are highly dependent upon timing. I know that there's been flow studies done up in this neck of the woods. There's actually minimum flow studies that are being done on the Shasta, I believe. As I've said, as an agency, we're moving towards that ourselves. The California Water Action Plan gets towards this. SGMA happened. SGMA, in some ways, was an output of the drought, and the gift of the drought is one of the few gifts of the drought, besides to maybe set a mark of where limitations lie. It seems like a model like this being run through a groundwater advisory group and a groundwater group that runs down to farmers and has the credibility of UC Davis, my alma mater, by the way, you know, the whole thing lines up well to be a useful tool, with Siskiyou County being a partner in that. And I think that is the actual intent of SGMA in some ways, that becomes a rational mechanism of SGMA and the intent of SGMA to truly manage groundwater. And it manages it not just for human beings, it manages it for where we're at, which is the more broad spectrum beneficial use. And I think that is the intent here. So I think I've always been amazed that, you know, this amount of scientific study got brought to this little basin, and I think it just really, really pays us dividends today.
Thanks to the people that worked there.
Mr. John.
I just wanted to personally thank you in the quality of your work. And people talk all the time about how you can incorporate science into policymaking, and this is one of the most perfect, best examples I can think of. And so,
You're welcome.
It's always a pleasure to hear from you.
Any other questions? We do have a speaker card for Mr. Felice Pace. So I'd ask, just come on up. Felice, I gave you additional time. You asked for 10 minutes and I gave you 6.
I know.
All right.
I appreciate it.
No sweat.
I appreciate it greatly.
And your best 6 minutes.
And I won't say anything bad about UC Davis as a result.
Thank you.
My name is
your tongue hurt or?
Yeah. My daughter graduated there too. And my name is Felice Pace. I'm representing the North Group of the Redwood Chapter of the Sierra Club, and I have a comment there, and I hope you will take the time to read it. I supported the development of this model. I think it's a good model. It's given us a better understanding. I had some questions which were answered earlier today about the calibration and the sensitivity of the model, and we're going to be looking at more of that information as time goes on, I guess, with these publications. I do need to take issue with something that Dr. Harder said. I believe that the critical low flow period for the Scott extends well after October 1st. But the problem is the model doesn't give you any water then, so that was sort of ignored. In some years, we have had problem getting even the coho up into the Scott Valley to that habitat that would be enhanced by these flows, these summer flows, that we've had problems even into December. So our critical low flow period starts at October 1st. And the model anticipates orders of magnitude, I'm quoting here, more diversion that's needed in order to be able to get an increase in summer flows. But we don't get a real increase. And I think some of those graphs were not right, were not consistent with the reports in terms of showing some fall flows. But actually, the papers say we don't get, the model says we don't get fall flows increases that are significant. It's still a good model. And it's good for evaluating, as you said, the sigma options. We need to remember it's a model, it's not the reality. But in 2016, UC Davis team joined with Scott Valley Irrigation District and secured a grant from the State Water Board for groundwater recharge. That actually were not eligible for that because that was an emergency program established by the governor in his drought declaration, and you had to have an urgent need. You were supposed to have an urgent need for the water. But in any case, they got funded, and they did that project. Demonstrated recharge, evaluate impacts on alfalfa. Now, there were several, though, troubling aspects of what happened. First of all, there was no coordination with Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I'm told, well, that's going to happen in the future, but why was there no coordination with DFW? The other thing is, they didn't just divert a constant rate. Sometimes they didn't divert at all, and sometimes they diverted big amounts. Now, that becomes important in terms of dewatering reds, which are the salmon nests. It also becomes important in terms of, you know, out-migration. So fish need water year-round. They need water when they could produce, when this recharge could produce some in the summer. They also need water in the spring. So the devil's going to be in the details. But, you know, in the wells, quote, they... On page 9, the summary report states, they demonstrated water recharge. But in the summary report states this on page 9. With exception to the Brian Morris Ranch, where groundwater surface water elevation response could be monitored directly on the site, it was not possible to quantify the rise in groundwater surface elevation related to groundwater recharges versus natural recharge from precipitation. 8 of 9 monitoring sites and 7 of 8 wells, diversion of surface flows to groundwater storage did not raise the groundwater elevation and therefore did not enhance discharge from groundwater to Scott River. Summary report on page 24, the results suggest an order of magnitude increase in recharge would be necessary to impact late summer stream flow. The previously managed aquifer recharge simulations also indicated maximum gains in stream flow were not recognized until after several consecutive years of treatments. So I think we should still do this. The other thing is the failure, you know, they identified some other things, moving wells away from the river. When the Scott Valley interconnected groundwater was defined in the adjudication 1980, that line is fairly close to the river. Sometimes it's almost on the banks of the river. And a bunch of irrigation wells went in just outside that, so very close to the river. And they talk about in their first papers, you know, moving these wells back. Where's the simulation? We need to see the results of that. Maybe we'd get a better impact from that. Also, what are the results, the modeling results, if we were to end groundwater irrigation on the last day of summer, on September 20th? What would be the impact of that? So there might be better bang to the buck by using some of these, looking at some of these other scenarios. And if more money is put into this by the water board, we should look at that, because really we need to be very concerned about those fall flows. Yes, the late summer flows are important. The fall flows are much more important. If we can't get the fish even to the Scott Valley, we can't, you know, utilize any habitat that's created up there. The other problem is that any water that's put in now can be taken by irrigators. Now, you heard Brian or one of them say, well, this isn't going to happen. I think it was Gus. Isn't going to happen. But when you raise the water level, the groundwater level, you decrease the cost of extracting the water. And that, I'm trained as an economist. Any economist will tell you that creates an incentive to pump more. Whether it means going to rice, which uses more water, which some guys have done in some years, whether it means spreading it to other fields. They have other fields out there that aren't irrigated right now, so they could spread that water around. But you can't just assume that that water isn't going to be taken by somebody and pumped before it can reach the water. So really, for this to work, and I think there is a lot of potential for this, along with other kind of management things, we really have to have Sigma in place. And the earliest we're going to have that in place is 2024, and I see I'm supposed to stop. So thank you very much for the extra time.
Good job.
And I hope you read it.
No, really. Thank you. I appreciate your comments. Thanks, Felice. Brian, can I ask you to come back up? I just want to close out just a few questions here. For one, thanks for making this happen today. I think this is an important tool. I think it's a fantastic model to have to use in this basin specifically. This is a largely an ag basin with irrigated ag, specifically to a high water crop that's predominantly a high water crop of alfalfa. As it goes then, I would ask that as this goes forward, this isn't part of the water board process per se of our business. This is the outcome of TMDL and community action, grant monies, UC Davis, and empowering a community here. But I would ask, again, our interest being the TMDL, the flows, the quality of water out here, please keep us informed as we go forward. If in fact these projects do happen, I'm interested in the public process of what happens. Not that we're as a board going to do something with that, but just so that we're aware of that kind of information. If there's outcomes here that you think would be of interest or good news or bad news otherwise, I would really like to know that, because I think to hear Dr. Harder that, you know, that this becomes the model for statewide, I mean, I've been up in Siskiyou County enough to know that I think Samantha Olson said it was spicy up there to deal with some of the community, and I think that's probably a good adjective. That, you know, if we could do it here in Scott Valley, given the conditions, and have some success up here and demonstrate success, I think that's huge. I think it's absolutely huge to show that there's not an incompatibility here. And by the way, Felicia, I hear you. I think it's right that, you know, with many of our things, you know, with a model to go forward to validate this model, to make sure and try other things with it and experiment with this model, that's the intent of Sigma, I believe. That's the intent of how we're supposed to iteratively go through groundwater management. And it's never going to be straight ahead. That water just doesn't move in a straight line. So as it goes, I just want to say thank you. Thank you, Dr. Harder and Gus. Good luck on getting that PhD, man. Come back and talk to us. You've been here several times, and I really, really appreciate your work, and you too, Brian, on your flow work.
I would be more than happy to keep the board up to date on developments as they, you know, occur. It's a good story to tell.
Good stuff. It's very good stuff. Any comments or questions for these guys? Fantastic. Thank you very much, you guys.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to continue the discussion on all things Siskiyou. Today, we have an update to the Shasta River Water